Welcome back to the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast from MIT Department of Urban Studies and Planning. I am Samra Lacko, MCP Class of 2020.
And I'm Tiffany Ferguson, MCP 2018. And now that you know who we are, let's get into the episode.
We're back. This time to talk about
public transit.
Yay. Well, a city is only a city if it has multimodal transit options. You know what I mean?
Samra, I think that is one of the most planning school things I've ever heard you say. But yes, sure. I'm just going to let that one go. To kick us off, in today's episode, we explore the universe of public transit and how it was impacted by the pandemic. In U.S. cities, we know that subway ridership fell at one point, according to Forbes, 80% in New York, and globally, as much as 95% in London.
That pretty much sums up the extent of my knowledge on the pandemic's impact on transit. So going into this episode, we wanted to take an exploratory stance. We spoke with Andre Svedsuk, an associate professor at DUSP, and Lindy Way Rennert, DUSP MCP 2016 and current PhD student at the London School of Economics. Here's Andres in his own words.
My name is Andres Svedsuk. I am an associate professor of urban science and planning in DUSP, where I also run the City Forum Lab. Much of my research is concerned with how we can make cities less dependent on the automobile and thereby more sustainable, accessible, more diverse, and interesting and livable for all.
What I loved about Andres' work is that his lab connects a very technical skill set to a very traditional industry. He's developing programming tools and methods of measurement and offering them to transportation planners to help them make better decisions. I compare it to the upgrade from the abacus to the TI-89 calculator. He's trying to give transportations their TI-89. No shade to the abacus. Here's a little bit more about his lab.
So the City Forum Lab is one of the research groups in DUSP. As the name of the lab suggests, we are largely interested in how the structure of the built environment, the form of the city at large, and this includes the land use patterns, its physical form, its infrastructure patterns, etc., how that influences quality of life in cities. And so much of the work that we do in the lab is to try to understand how the form of the city impacts the mobility dynamics, how and where people move in cities, using what modes, what percentage or share of those movements happen on different technologies like public transport or personal car versus walking and cycling, which desirably we would love to increase. In the lab, we have developed various tools that help also other researchers and other planners and urban designers and scholars examine cities. And in particular, I'm referring to, for instance, the urban network analysis tools, which are a plugin that works with GIS or more recently, predominantly with Rhino software, and that allows people to analyze cities as spatial networks. And this is really key because once we have a representation of cities as a spatial network, we can also understand some of the dynamics that go on in cities along networks between different interacting land uses, people, places, demographic characteristics of those people, etc. So a lot of the lab work has been concerned by developing tools that make it possible to analyze these interrelationships between urban form mobility dynamics, but also to study other questions like, for instance, land use location preferences, or in my case, oftentimes, amenity location patterns. I've recently written a book about street commerce entitled Street Commerce, Creating Vibrant Urban Sidewalks. And it's really an attempt to understand how patterns of retail service, food, and personal establishments in city on city streets along sidewalks come to be, what forces shape their patterns, and what can planners and policymakers do to affect those patterns? How can we make the kind of convenience and benefits that street commerce offers more accessible to more people? Kind of what strings can we pull to fundamentally change or affect that pattern? And that's also something that is benefited a lot from using these network analysis tools we've developed in the lab. So we can empirically study their patterns using spatial statistics, using modeling, using accessibility and movement models, and really be able to do the work empirically, analyze the patterns we observe and make sense of them.
So here we have Andres, an expert on street commerce who published a book about street life and vibrant sidewalks in 2020. I couldn't wait to hear his thoughts on how the pandemic turned so much of our conventional wisdom on its head. Or did it? Here's Andres putting a finer point on how and why that massive shift in mobility that was brought on by the pandemic created a lot of losers, but also created some winners too.
People are, at least over the last 2-3 years, more stuck in their home environment. And that has had very direct consequences on street life and street commerce. As an interesting fact, we hear a lot in the media how retailers have and food businesses have taken quite a hit in some places like Greater Boston. One of the surveys conducted by MAPC suggested that something like 60% of all small businesses are under threat of going out of business because of the pandemic. It's an enormous number. But there's actually, interestingly, quite a bit of diversity in that. In some instances, in neighborhoods where people have been home, the local stores have actually been doing better than before the pandemic because the demand is right there. Now, traditionally, most of the kind of economic enterprises that do retail and food services and personal services, they tend to be actually close to jobs in downtowns and local subcenters. These ones have taken an enormous hit because that lack of commuting to work has really cut down on access to those businesses. And they are the places also where most street commerce has been forced to go out of business. The pandemic has also, of course, upped the e-commerce demand, but that very much predates the pandemic. It was already on a kind of meteoric rise before the pandemic. The pandemic has just given it a big extra step. I would love to see more cities do that, but what's been a welcome shift is how cities respond to the kind of threat of e-commerce. I criticized earlier this idea of a big corporate box store that siphons profits out of communities into some headquarters in a REIT or fund out in Wall Street, right? Amazon is exactly that. Amazon is, you know, making it extremely convenient for us to get stuff, but none of the money we pay over the screen and a click to Amazon will stay in our community. None of it, right? And it doesn't provide any of the additional benefits of making streets interesting and giving us opportunities to meet with people.
Yeah, so this sounds quite dismal. We know that retail suffered in the pandemic, but there are some bright spots that he brought up next.
Cities have started to question how to counter that. And what I'd love to see is this innovation in the kinds of apps and services that give the control back to local businesses. For instance, our very own Boston has produced Toast, which is an app that gives the control in the hands of the business to take digital orders without having to rely on DoorDash or Uber Eats or somebody else who will take a 25% cut of their fees. And there's been quite a lot of thinking about how to blend this kind of e-commerce phenomenon by giving the control back to small businesses or local businesses. And I think that's been a somewhat kind of a positive side that this thinking has occurred. There's probably not quite enough of it. So what else has occurred in terms of what the impact of pandemic is on all this? As I mentioned, I'm very interested in kind of non-auto-centric mobility in cities and how cities can produce that for all. Unfortunately, pandemic has put people back in the cars and driving much longer distances. We don't quite know the answer why they're driving or traveling longer distances, but it's well published, many papers on that. The average travel distance people do on a day has grown. There's probably two explanations. One is that they do more of their trips in cars rather than public transit, walking, cycling, which tend to be shorter trips in general. But partly it's also a matter of, I think that our schedules have changed enormously with the pandemic. We've been more at home than at work. And by giving us more flexibility in schedules, we've kind of been less constrained by the pre-pandemic meeting schedule and work schedule. And that has given people an opportunity to take a trip in the middle of the day or get in their car and go somewhere where they normally wouldn't have done before the pandemic. But to counter that, the sort of extra vehicular mobility that the pandemic has made happen, is also being somewhat exciting to see some cities try to put in place investments and transit construction that can be done during the low time. So I live in Somerville, and I really look forward to the Green Line opening up, the Green Line extension, which has really been built out just during the pandemic. I mean, almost all of its construction has been in the last 3 years, and it's about to open later this summer. It really comes down to what do cities, you know, we've been thrown a lemon, a massive lemon, but what do we make of it? It really varies by cities. It's sort of a no-action laissez-faire has regressed many cities into kind of undoing a lot of the progress we had on increasing non-motorized mobility and making streets more walkable and supporting small business, et cetera. And when we don't take action, Amazon takes over. But in cities where action has been very purposeful, in transit investments, in more street investments, and of course, just supporting community directly with federal funds and state funds to make sure that businesses survive and families don't get evicted, et cetera. Taking those policy steps has been differentiating those cities that really care how to make the best of the worst pandemic that we've got.
So in hearing Andres talk, it seems like there's a lot of good and concerning things that are happening right now in public transit in the world of street commerce.
From our conversation with Andres, it's pretty clear he has some thoughts about what an ideal city should be aspiring towards. That made me curious about two things. One, what does that ideal future city look like from a mobility perspective? And two, are there any opportunities that have emerged from the pandemic that we can build on to get closer to that representation of the city?
My kind of ideal of a future city is not entirely car-free. The big difference is it's not overwhelmingly dominated by the car, which is the legacy of the 20th century. But we all need smaller private access sometimes. Some people need it on a daily basis who are not able to walk enough to get to public transport or to get to their destinations on foot, and they have to get in a car. And even us who are able-bodied, we need to carry luggage or heavy groceries every once in a while and need to get around. So I don't think that's an issue. Putting the car as one of the modes on the streets, but not letting it occupy 90% of all infrastructure and putting 90% of all funding into its future growth is the issue. So I think there's plenty of cities like that. Generally, all we need to do is just look at the pie chart of the modal share and cities where you have sustainable modes, including walking, cycling, and public transit above 60%, 70%, they're all great. That'll be on all continents practically. So, you know, in Europe, plenty of capitals hit that benchmark. In Asia, places like Tokyo or parts of Seoul will hit that benchmark. There's a myriad different configurations. The pandemic has allowed American cities in particular to discover what street life feels like with these expanded seating areas. And it was interesting in the beginning of the pandemic when these things started coming about, that heat lamps came up, and some people started saying, like, wait a second, I've seen that before. I've seen that in Paris. Yes, street life has always been on the street in Paris. Every single brasserie or cafe will spill out on the street, and they have always had heaters in the winter. That's just how it is. And I think it's a great discovery that now a lot of cities are keen to keep it around and have tried to kind of make sure that we don't shift back to pre-pandemic typologies from that. What's been perhaps a little bit less successful, in my view, is I'm fully in support of the kind of community streets movement and slow streets movements, the shared streets movements that are also occurred during the pandemic, where some streets are, you know, mixed traffic and people on the street. I'd love to see that work better. A lot of them were implemented without careful analysis of, will this actually work on this very street, or how successful will it be here? And as a result, many of them have utterly failed. I mean, even here in Cambridge, a lot of the shared street programs were put into place where nobody was going to walk anyway. And so the drivers are the only people on the street, and they just go and ask, why is this down to 5 miles an hour? There's just nobody going to use the street anyway. I think we should do that, but we should prioritize that in places that already have great potential for generating trips on foot and where that potential has been held back by just lack of space and lack of support.
We also asked Andres to expand on some of the examples of cities that are taking intentional action here. It seems like there aren't too many examples from the U.S., but some bright spots abroad. Here he goes into a little bit of his love for London and the high street.
The kind of love affair with high streets in London goes back a very long way, to the point when Even Napoleon has described England as a nation of shopkeepers. It's very important, not only because of some sort of functional commercial reason. High streets, which are the British equivalents of main streets, are really where urban life happens in London. And there is just a countless range of subsidies and programs that the Greater London Council and the City of London have been making available to support high streets. And according to some of the surveys I also cite in the book, over a half of all the people who are on high streets or main streets in London don't buy anything. They're not there to shop. They're there to look or meet other people. They're there to find opportunity. They're oftentimes people who are not in current employment. So they're either out of a job or they're too young or too old to work. And that's where they find communal interactions and opportunity they might be looking for. And so the City of London invests massively into the physical infrastructure improvements on high streets, which no single store has the incentive to do that, right? Why would I build a great sidewalk in front of my store? Because my neighboring store will benefit that. So it's a problem of the commons and it needs public interventions, including landscaping programs. There's business subsidies. But unlike any place that I found, some of the boroughs of London also quite directly step into the role of buying up vacant retail space that is not going on the market, that is basically empty storefronts, and then purposefully leasing them out under market value to the kinds of amenities and businesses that the city thinks the community needs, like a grocery store or whatever it be, a pharmacy, but not necessarily going to be an ATM that kills the street front and brings nothing of real value to the community. And so London has perhaps been this one case where there's just countless programs and different approaches to really put high streets at the center of what London wants to improve and where they see their kind of identity being built, including this hugely diverse international or multinational small businesses from all parts of the world in different ethnic neighborhoods of the city.
Andres has given us so much to chew on, and I'm excited to dig in now into the conversation with this episode's alum. Our next guest is DUSP alum, Lindy Wave Rennert, who has a background working as a transportation planner and is currently a PhD student at the London School of Economics.
My name is Lindy Wave Rennert. I am currently a PhD candidate at the London School of Economics in regional and urban planning, but my focus is entirely in the world of transit and the different ways that transit intersects with social justice, more specifically Black justice. And that is sometimes in the positive realm, right? Like transit as catalyst for justice and improvement and reparations and many wonderful things. And sometimes it's just pointing out failings, right? The way in which we in the world of transit have gotten it wrong, which usually leads to discussions of how we can do it better. So I do try and end on an uptick. But yeah, that's my umbrella and my intersection. And though I'm in London, most of my work is in a U.S. context, but certainly has global ramifications. But when you think of transit, there is this political arch, and so it's contextual. I tend to stay in the U.S.
Before we jump into Lindy Way's views on the pandemic, which are really interesting, I assure you, here's a little bit more about how she found her way to planning and the kind of work she's been doing since she left DUSP.
It's really funny. Every time, we get asked this question of what got you into planning, this career that many people only come to much later in life or only even hear of later on. The thing for transit planners, I find, and it's true for me as well, is that you're a little kid who's obsessed with trains. I mean, how can you not be obsessed with trains? It's just, I don't understand. So yeah, that's what got me into planning. This like love of mobility, this love of how do I get out of my parents' house and elsewhere? So that equals bikes, that equals buses, all these things. And I think growing up in different cities in which I did have access actually to quite a lot of vehicles of motion freedom, right? Which, I mean, you can call those, as I just said, bike, bus, train, whatever. And you start to ask questions of like, well, if I have to walk, 5 blocks to my house from my house to catch this bus. Does everybody have to walk 5 blocks? Who got to decide that I walked 5? My friend Gerald walked 6. You know, you start to ask these questions of how did this come to be the case? And once I learned that that's at least in part what planners get to work on, so began the deep dive of how do I build a career around this? How do I get a say in kind of these type of equations? And so that led me first to thinking that a career in public sector work, be that for a transit provider or a government agency that has more control over streets, would be where I could be of most use. And so I did a stint at the Boston Transportation Department, which was fantastic. I got to work very closely with the MBTA, with a lot of organizers, with activists and organizers, which was very rewarding work. It also allowed me to do this other element of the work that I love, which is just number crunching. I mean, there is this data element to the work that I do that I think a lot of planners, you either love it or hate it. Much like the little kid obsessed with trains, you either are or are not that weirdo. I was. In both cases, I am. And yeah, I get to play with numbers and see how they can be transformative, you know, not just in making an argument, but also in improving lives. And I have found them to be very helpful for me and have kind of built an entire study around making them helpful for others. So yeah, a little while in public sector. I was just before that at Nelson Niger. I was a consultant, which is where I kind of got to hone my skills. And now here I am, right, trying to teach. That's the whole point of this PhD. I really want to go into academia and kind of help others shape the questions that they ask as future planners.
We asked Lindy Way, same question we asked Andres, how did the pandemic shift her field of work?
We know transit in particular, transit services are disproportionately used by people of color. That is because people of color have been disproportionately forced into urban centers. That's a long history of housing. They are, in the time of COVID, transit's lifeline. Without communities of color, many transit organizations right now would be beyond bankrupt. They're your last consumer. Like, that is who is still riding trains. That is who is still riding buses. And that's because they make up such a large portion of the essential workforce.
We also asked Lindy Way how the public transit operators have been impacted and might be moving away from a self-funded model because ridership, as we know, is down. This is what she had to say.
We see some distribution of services which you can't deny. We're seeing routes that used to be lower frequency, but that certainly served less white neighborhoods. And that's largely because they were further from downtown where Black and brown folks have been pushed, right, through many different elements. Those routes are receiving higher frequency. So you can't argue that that is all lip service, right? That's an actual change in my quality of mobility experience. Great. That's the most visible one. I think we're also seeing places go fare free. There's a big debate about how long interjections like that will last. It's kind of like we're in a scenario where a lot of these providers are bleeding so much money, like insurmountable amounts of money, that it becomes a question of, well, why should profit or even breaking even be an objective anymore? Because it's impossible, right? So you start to genuinely change your entire mission of service. And I think smaller agencies that had a different relationship with how dependent they were on their revenue boxes are really making their recovery from customer service is what that means, right? Like, how much of my ability to continue providing service is dependent on riders paying me as opposed to government funding or other elements. They're making really big changes. I think some of these smaller services that go fare free will remain that way. I mean, for example, Mayor Michelle Wu has made 3 routes fare free in Boston. They're the highest percentage minority ridership routes. And she has guaranteed, I want to say, a few years.
So a quick recap before we go on to the next question. One is that as a result of the pandemic, there were routes that ran less frequently that increased in frequency. And that was because the need was there. And many of those neighborhoods, predominantly communities of color, had essential workers who still needed to move through the city. So during the pandemic, we essentially saw a responsiveness on the part of public transit operators to serve the communities where the need was highest. The other thing that's coming through loud and clear is there's a more existential question around whether determining routes and route frequency should solely be based on user fees and budgetary constraints. And so instead, maybe we should start with where the service needs are and then think through a pricing and user fee strategy that makes sense for those communities. And this kind of shines through in Lindyway's example about Boston sort of moving forward with making a few select routes free. Now what's buzzing around in my head is, how do we make choices around what routes are set, who gets served, and how we evaluate those choices? What are the metrics? What are the tools that transportation planners use to help us know how close or far we are from meeting the needs of different groups and communities?
Other things that we tend to measure are environmental related, right? So kind of our per capita output as a result of our transit mode choices. Useful metrics, and certainly useful for success objectives in the world of kind of our per city carbon output, for example. Those are necessary things, and we're measuring them currently, so that's great. Things that are not being measured that I would love to see used as justifications for doing well, or arguments that we are doing well, that we are improving the state of equity within our cities, are maybe things kind of like exposure-based metrics. So I've done a lot of reading, right, that argues that the overarching theme here is that riding transit actually makes you less likely to have racially unjust or racially prejudicial or straight up racist views toward other people that you generally don't interact with in your life. This is very interesting to me and also totally believable. This idea that if we're on this bus together, it's a shared moment, whether I know you from a can of paint or not, whether I see you ever again in my lifetime. It's a shared moment, be it a positive one or a negative one. And there's good psychological research that actually argues the negative moments bring us closer together. But that's not to say we should be making transit worse for the sake of humanity. Still, these ideas that the quality of our transit may be impacting the amount of time per day or the likelihood per day that I am to share an experience with a person of a different race from me. That's an interesting metric. We don't measure likelihood, we don't measure exposure, and we don't measure the role that mode choice has in that. And that strikes me as something that could be really cool. And if we start to place a value on that, without question, the single occupancy vehicular mode choice falls at the wayside as far as its contribution to our overall state of humanity, our overall state of collectivism, right? And if we were measuring that, I think cars would get far less space on our streets than collective modes.
I like the way that Lindyway frames it because it makes me curious about the role that transit plays in strengthening communities. We often focus just on how people are moving around to get to work or to their jobs, but it's also the foundation of a community is physical space and who you're interacting with on that space. And it also gets to the point that I think a lot of people always ask about public transit, which is why should non-transit users care? The next thing that we asked Lindyway was, what's your big idea in transit once you're done with your PhD? What is it that you hope to do?
I would love to turn a lot of the things I've learned and the things that I feel into children's books, because I think kids are not exposed enough early on to the planning process. And again, I'm putting up air quotes, planning process, because it's not the kids' fault. The planning process is the issue. But nonetheless, these things, often planning elements, hugely impact children and the way that they access their world, their scope of world. I mean, that's when I fell in love with planning. Who's to say that other kids aren't having similar thoughts but don't know how to maybe compartmentalize them or don't see themselves as an active agent in that world? And I think they totally can be. And I also just kind of like the idea of at some point, maybe, you know, reading my own kids a book about how, whatever, kid got a bike, what did the bike expose that child to, right? Access and these ideas, but in a very tangible way. So yes, eventually I hope my work has as wide an audience as kids.
Our final question for our two guests was about what they were excited about. You'll hear Andres first talk about a transportation project he's working on, and then Lindyway on biking infrastructure.
One of the things I'm very excited about right now is an idea that we call pedestrian impact assessment tied to real estate development. when cities permit projects, when somebody wants to develop a new building of a certain size, usually above 100,000 square feet or somewhere thereof, they have to conduct environmental impact assessment. And one of the very critical components of that is traffic impact assessment. If that study, the traffic impact assessment, shows that the project is going to create too much traffic for the streets to handle, then there are legal mechanisms in US states and cities to make the developer help pay for the mitigation. And as a result, what happens is that you build a big project, and then the developer also has to help pay for road widening, signal readjustments, extra turning lanes, and this kind of stuff. Perversely, what we call environmental review constantly kind of channels money back to more traffic on city streets, because that's the impact we're analyzing. Vehicular traffic impact of the project. And say, I've been working hard to figure out, how can we do that instead for non-motorized modes? How could the city government require that a new development project has to do pedestrian impact assessment or transit impact assessment? And so that if you're going to charge developers to mitigate some of the mobility effects they have, that better use that funding to make a better sidewalk or better public park or space nearby, make crossing safer. And this is all reliant on the digital tools we've been building and others have been building, that we can actually have a forecasting system in place that says, if you put this land use here with that much density, given its context and what's already around it, this is likely going to be the modal split of how people will move there. And this is how they will distribute geographically on the city streets, right? We want to make sure that we can extend this to, or use this to forecast the non-motorized impacts of development, so that the city can prioritize new developments at places where they're going to get a better outcome, so that we don't move in the opposite direction of project by project, producing more traffic and moving in this sort of more motorization direction. And we've done several papers to show that this actually can work. We can actually accurately forecast what happens with pedestrian mobility after a project is complete. So doing this before and after analysis, the bigger hurdle moving forward will be to work with city governments who are interested in piloting or adopting an approach like this to actually change how they do development review and approvals.
Sometimes it's surprisingly bleak. Like in the early stages of the pandemic, I mean, I think we were seeing such hope, especially in the world of cycling. I mean, cycling infrastructure, the barriers that have existed for planners and organizers and activists in that world really came down quickly in the world of early onset COVID, right? We were putting up temporary lanes. People were buying bikes. I mean, bikes were sold out in London. When I say, like, you couldn't get a bike to save your life, which is great, right? That felt like mode shift that could last, right? However, as this has prolonged, and for a host of reasons that I'm sure those who specialize in cycling would have much better reflections on, some of it is that those temporary infrastructure elements have now gone away and therefore made cycling less enticing and things like that.
The pandemic was such a rich petri dish for mobility. It gives us a whole new tapestry for understanding how we use cities, where we go within them, how we get there, and why. It challenges so many dominant narratives and paradigms about how people engage in and through cities. And so I'm really sitting with the excitement from our two speakers about all the changes they witnessed during the pandemic and how they're eager to see these learnings get translated into sustained efforts. Samer, what about you? What are you taking away?
I can say for myself that the thing that really stuck out is that a lot of our transit decisions, I think as planners we know, but we don't often talk enough about, is how political transit decisions are, because money towards public transit is money away from other programs, and often that money is going towards disproportionately people of color who are using public transit. I think that the framing around streeteries and commerce and community development is a really great framework to sort of take that discussion of almost like money that's being given away, because it's not a service that pays for itself. It often is a drain. It's a really interesting way of reframing that conversation as something that is a public good for everyone, which I think we know it is. And both Lindy Way and Andres sort of get to that point in their own way. The second thing that really interested me or that maybe was my interest before going into this, was bikes. You know, we're seeing people move around differently, and people have always said that the U.S. is a car-based society, and it's definitely still is. But the growth of biking infrastructure is really interesting. And I actually just rode e-bikes this weekend. I think both Tiffany and I have tried out e-bikes. It is so much fun. And I went with a friend, actually, who's interested in buying one, and learned that the industry is projected to grow by 40 billion, to grow to 40 billion by 2033. So now I want one. I'm taking note of bike paths and the cyclists and realizing that it's really changed the way that I personally am interacting with the city. And, you know, it is more of a street level mode of transportation.
That's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed, and we'll tune again to another episode of season 2 of Planning Ideas That Matter.
Thank you to today's guests,
Andres Svetsuk and Lindy Way Rennert.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast, a production by the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Our theme song was composed and recorded by DUSP alumni band Eminent Domain. Other music in the season by Blue Dot Sessions. This season is co-hosted by Tiffany Ferguson and Samra Lako. Co-produced by Takeo Kuwabara, Dave Lashansky, Tiffany Ferguson, and Samra Lako. Our audio engineer is Dave Lashansky. This season is made possible through the generosity of the Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at MIT in the form of BEMIS funding and through the support of DUSP's headquarters, faculty, and staff. Thank you. And we would like to extend a special thank you to all of our faculty and alumni guests for their time and reflections. Until next time.